news. As we looked at the flyer of the superlative text, The Ark Before Noah, decoding the story of the flood, everyone knows the story of Noah's Ark and the flood as recounted in the book of Genesis. Let's just check that, Gabriella, the story of the flood and the Ark?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah. Definitely Genesis.
And Rachel?
Yes.
And Holly?
Yep.
Marvellous. Since the 1870s, it has been known that a similar but much older story existed centuries before in ancient Babylon, but much was shrouded in mystery. One day, Irving Finkel, a curator in the British Museum and a world authority on ancient Mesopotamia, found himself involved in a detective story of decipherment and discovery when a member of the public arrived at the museum with a particular cuneiform tablet which he had inherited from his father. Cue Dr. Irving Finkel. Good afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Glad to be talking to you.
And likewise, we're delighted that you're actually online than that, baby, because the even more exciting thing is that you're coming to Lincoln to take part as one of the key highlights of the second festival. It's true. The excitement is palpable in the whole city of Lincoln.
I'm really looking forward to it.
The Lincoln Drill Hall on Saturday at 2 p.m. But we need to go back in time to a certain extent. I mean, I've been reading through The Ark Before Noah. I think it's a fantastic read. It's gripping. It's an, I'm speaking as somebody first degree chemistry and biology, or science, but not archaeology and lines from that. But it's extraordinarily well written and takes us all the way back to the whole notions of cuneiform writings and some wonderful historical elements as well. Gilgamesh, all these areas. The photographs as well, superb.
I mean, in terms of. I'm really glad you approve.
Yeah, well, I mean, the author, age 9, in Exeter Museum, talking for the first time about becoming a British Museum curator. Was it age 9 when you actually sort of decided to become a British Museum curator?
Yes, and it was literally true because I was upstairs in that museum with a friend of our family who had a Brownie 127. And when I was up there, her name was Pamela. My father was a dentist, and she was his assistant. And we went out for the day, and I said to her, you know, when I grow up, I want to work in the British Museum. And she took that photograph there and then. Mm. And when I was writing this book, I had lunch with her, and I mentioned something about illustrations. And she said, you know, I've got an idea. And then about a week later, that photograph came in the post. It was such an adventure.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that is really at the heart of this, because it's more than just the excitement of a kind of cross between Raiders of the Lost Ark and cuneiform and the Da Vinci Code. So this is the, I mean, share with us, Dr. Winkel, the whole sort of notion of how the thing developed and you know, the essence of this, because you know, most folk would say, well, okay, historically it may have happened, it did happen, we've gone through the Ark and so on. Certainly, I don't think Noah ever looked like Russell Crowe. In fact, as we've said, if they were casting, surely you are ideally placed to take on board the mantle. It's true.
I haven't got the contract yet. The thing is, everybody knows the story intimately from childhood, from the Bible. I mean, it's part of the fabric of Western society, really. All people know about Noah and the Ark, even if they don't know the thing by heart, they know the basic story. And since the 19th century, as you said, it has been known that in ancient Mesopotamia, for many centuries earlier, we had the same story there, and it's always been quite likely, I think, in most people's minds, that that's where the story began, because ancient Mesopotamia, which is the land which corresponds to modern Iraq, which is fed by the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, is a kind of place where major floods did happen and do happen. And I think a lot of people think that the story is generated by some memory of a very ancient, very destructive sort of tsunami which happened in prehistory or something and lasted in people's minds. And the threat of it lasted, and that the story of the Ark is the kind of answer to it, how life at the last minute was saved in the past and would always be saved in the future, something like that.
Well, I recall in my youth, obviously, the animals going in two by two and all of the other wonderful words that come through from that perspective. But we do seem to be revisiting this. Is it partly because of the sort of sense of global warming and climate change and so on? We're finding this even more resonant with respect to our current histories.
I think that's possibly true, because when you live in the countryside, you take nature for granted and it's a real force. But when you live in a big urban complex with streets and, you know, factories and God knows what else, when you're cut off from nature, you tend to put it all at the back of your mind. And, you know, it rains or it's hot, but the force of nature is something that very many people who live in an urban environment never encounter. Then someday you go on holiday once and you're in a tent and the heavens open and everything gets washed away from under your feet and you suddenly remember, really, the force of nature. And if you end up in a major thing, then you never forget it. And I think when there's been a lot of talk about global warming and the consequences, and then even more specifically the floods that suddenly started to beleaguer the British Isles, it was about the same time as my book came out. People were muttering. In fact, one or two people rang out and said, "Is this all your fault?"
it's a bit of an excessive publicity campaign, Irving.
That's what I thought. It's a bit over the top.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Hodder and Stoughton are a fantastic company, but really, you know,
I would have drawn the line at that. Yeah. I quite agree with you. But it is a very resonant story, and I think apart from the force of nature, there's also the key component that the flood story in the Bible and the one in the Babylonian version before it have this irresistible matter that the world is going to be destroyed quickly. There's not much time to go. There's a time bomb, and one chap has got a short period of time to come up with this thing to rescue life for the future. And that mechanism, that sort of plot element, is a very strong thing. It underpins a good proportion of the work of Hollywood in general. Mm. You know, Martians arrive, there's one handsome chap with blonde hair and good muscles who's got 117 hours and 4 seconds to diffuse, you know, all this stuff.
I spend so much time doing that, it's unbelievable, but, you know, one does one's best, really.
One does, especially at the same time you're having to advertise aftershave and that kind of thing.
Of course.
But I think you could say that as a story, as a compelling human interest, vulnerable to nature, God can be cross, God can forgive sort of thing, is very telling. And it was telling for the Babylonians, and it was telling for the Hebrews and the text of Genesis when the Bible was finally being sort of formalized. I think that story was adopted and recast in order to explain a very potent thing, that bad behavior is always going to be punished. And that's the gist of the Genesis story.
So was the Babylonian one to do with repristination then?
Well, it's interesting. The gods in heaven in the Babylonian story about 1,000 years earlier, they decided to wipe everything out because they were noisy. And it's explicit in the flood story epic. And the way to visualize it from the text is pretty clear, really, because the gods are sitting about, as it were, in deck chairs, as it were, after a heavy lunch. And there's a lot of racket. And Enlil, who is the chief god, who's trying to go to sleep, keeps getting woken up by the noise, and eventually he puts his foot down and says, "We're going to obliterate all this, and we're going to start again." And in the Babylonian account of the decision to wipe out all life on the planet, it was attributed to this tiresome business of noise. Now, to a modern mind, that is a bit bizarre. But as a matter of fact, there is a deeper message probably in the original story, because a lot of scholars feel that what's really at stake here is overpopulation, because when the first creation took place in ancient Mesopotamia, in the mythological account of it, the gods forgot to create death and things like that.
A bit of an oversight, really. I mean, at least the Egyptians actually had Seth as
that's all they did. The Egyptians say it's all they did. I'm surprised any of them were alive at all. No, but the thing is this, I agree with you, it was a bit careless, but on the other hand, it was their first try. So what happened was that I think the human race proliferated to such an extent that the noise means all that goes with that noise. And although the last minute the god Enki intervened and foiled the plan so that the boat was built and life carried on, the gods did institute, at the end of the story, death in society, and they prescribed that certain women would have to be barren, certain women would have to be this and that, so that the numbers, as it were, would be under control. So it's something to do with that. But what we can say for certain is that the theological framework which led to the development of the flood story in Mesopotamia was nothing to do with sin or immoral behavior, and that is the only thing that was interesting in the Bible.
Rachel, any thoughts or questions from yourself?
I just think it's brilliant that it was too noisy. Get rid of people. I'm trying to sleep.
You know that thing when you're on the beach and other people have children or radios, that sort of somewhere over there flap of the hand racket thing? It comes across in the Babylonian that they're kind of really annoyed by it, you know, it's kind of irritating. I think that's a rather human thing. I like that very much.
It's like being on the underground, you've got tinny headphones going all the time. Just smite them. That's the whole thing. Smite them. Thou shalt not have your MP3s played at such a high level. It's not good.
You need to take this up with the leading religious authorities. I'm definitely going to march behind you on that. I think it will be... I mean, sometimes when I sit get on the bus, I'm the only human being with two empty earlobes. I mean,
yeah, it's just, it's enough's enough. Okay, you might be listening to a podcast of the Midweek Drive on Siren FM, but, you know, still, there's a time and a place.
I agree.
Gabriella, any questions from yourself?
I read up about you a bit, and it said you did a dissertation on Babylonian exorcistic spells against demons.
I thought that was
quite interesting if you could talk a bit about it, because I didn't know that back then they would have these kind of spells.
And that's something the BBC wouldn't have even asked about, his dissertation on exorcistic spells. Very good.
Well, I don't mention it at parties because people move away. But it's a very interesting subject because they certainly believed in a whole load of demons and ghosts and witches who could interfere and all those sorts of things. They had a very complicated network of things. And there were certain demons who were very powerful and easy to identify. For example, there was one called Lamashtu, who was ghastly looking with long talons and bird's feet, and she liked pregnant women and new babies, so she was a really clear danger. And they had amulets against her and spells against her, magic words. One of them was this, that oh, Lamashtu, it says, I know who you are, these are your names, and it says 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, it gives all the names, so that the exorcist showed that she couldn't hide from his attention. Even if she adopted a name or a secret name, or she hid behind somebody else's name, he knew who she was. And they had these spells, which are partly a mixture of magic words, like all kinds of systems, and partly, go away, O demon, leave me alone, I am a this, I walk under the protection of the gods, and lots of other things as well. And there was a class of professional exorcists who knew how to give people amulets or to do rituals to prevent them, for example, from getting ill if they thought they might be, or to make them better if they were. And they had a whole sort of professional network with people at the top with very expensive materials and very expensive amulets, and then people in villages, wise women who knew this and that to help help in times of trouble. But they believed that they had a lot of gods. There's a big pantheon in ancient Mesopotamia with big gods and little gods, and a lot of demons with big demons and little demons, and also ghosts. And ghosts were human, and ghosts are much more, much less something to worry about. They had exorcisms for ghosts, but they weren't really frightened of them. They felt sorry for them, really. Because they didn't rest properly in the underworld. Because when you die, you're supposed to go down there and be quiet and everything's fine. But people
being so noisy, for goodness sakes.
For example. But people who got killed in an accident or something like that, or didn't get their final rites, they came back and they hung around and, you know, moved up sources on the washing up or something. And
that sounds awful. That sounds really bad.
But But what's really interesting, what I find absolutely marvellous about it, is that in all the texts, there's quite a lot of things to do with ghosts. There's never any question whatsoever about whether they exist or not. And nobody said to somebody else, do you really believe in ghosts? And the person said, well, look, don't tell anybody but yes, or don't tell anybody but no, because everybody did. It's perfectly clear that they were taken for granted as an element of life. And I've got a hunch, although I don't think we can prove it very readily, or perhaps you can do a survey, I've got a hunch that this is still true, and that really everybody believes in ghosts. And lots of people will poo-poo it and say, oh, there's no evidence, or it's all fakery, or it's all this or that. But you put them in a funny house in the middle of the moors one night with a wind whistling round, and then some schmuck goes, woo-woo, they'll all die of fright.
Yes.
So I think it's a permanent human thing. What do you think?
I do think so.
It's an archetype. It's in there. As Jung would have actually said with respect to his race memories and so on. Dr. Finkel, we could talk for hours, quite literally, about this. It's fantastic stuff. A reminder that the book is available published by Hudder & Stoughton. Of course, Channel 4 making a film about the tablet. That's going to be happening later on. But the most exciting thing, as far as the Lincoln listener is concerned, is you can actually meet Dr. Irving Finkel in person at the Art Reform, exactly on Saturday the 10th of May at the Lincoln Drill Hall. We have two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link on this, your Midweek Drive debut, Dr. Finkel?
I think it's lovely. I could talk to you guys for hours. There's so many interesting things. So I tell you what, we'll all meet on Saturday and carry on.
Do you know, round of applause, eh? Absolutely. I take it then you've answered the second question. Dr. Irving Finkel will return.
I will return. Lovely. See you soon, then.
writing in, I was always under the impression most stories from the Bible came about due to real events that happened to much earlier civilizations. The story about the possible origin of Noah and the Ark from Mesopotamia was fascinating. Drown the noisy people, says Penny Evans. Drown the noisy people. LOL there. Hey, I'm well interested in the supernatural. Well, of course, you're an X-File person, Penny. Marvellous. One of the most interesting interviews you've had, Alex. All this happening on Penny's husband's birthday, May the 10th. Only in Lincoln. Celebrate and rejoice. It gets even better because we talked obviously with Dr. Irving Finkel, and now it is time for the book that I have been just stroking with joy and happiness over the last few moments. And the sound that signifies the magic that can only signify what, Rachel Warren?
Fringe.
Yes! And in my hand it's the Fringe September's Notebook, written of course by the fabulous Tara Bennett, with Paul Terry's help. But Tara Bennett's with us. How are you, Tara?
Hello, it's so nice to be back. Good evening to you guys.
There is no doubt after the startlingly wonderful debut that you actually provided for the whole system that, you know, you would return. And of course, people might say, oh, September's Notebook, why about the month of September? No, it's the character. The character of September. Yeah, one of the observers who's actually there. Gabriella, random page number, please, between 1 and 150.
98.
You've gone for. What magical thing comes into 98?
I seem to be like an 8 today.
Yeah, clearly. It's a very significant in every sense of the words that we've actually got there. And there we actually have, there's more than one of everything. Walternut, despite being witness to countless moments in humanity's evolution throughout the ages and across universes, I am still most intrigued by the details that fail to waver, regardless of universe, and conversely, the deviations that occur for the smallest of reasons. For as complex a man as Walter Bishop is, it was logical to me that his versions in each universe would be so distinctive, depending on his environment and circumstances. However, the Dr. Walter Bishop from over there, who evolved in response to the kidnapping of his son, has been one of the most intriguing to understand and observe. Beware, at the moment, Tara, Rachel Warren might just collapse with excitement and joy because I've just passed over the Fringe September Notebook to Rachel Warren, and there you go, Rachel. It's exciting, isn't it?
Very exciting.
I've never had anybody read it to me. I'm so excited. It's so excited. Ooh, that's new.
And it's a truly wonderful piece, as we said, where we did a piece with Parsec and Dave Milling precisely about this. You know, as indeed Paul Terry said, he couldn't have done it without you, Tara. It's bottom line. You know?
Oh, no, I couldn't have done it without him. We're so proud of it. It was one of the most, we love that show, and then it was just like a kid in a candy store for the two of us book nerds to be able to really kind of do something inside the mythology of the show and not just, here's how they made it, but really do something that feels like it, you know, is a piece of the show. So it was a long year of working on it, but we're very, very proud of it and super happy that the fans of Fringe, who are, you know, small but incredibly vocal and passionate about the show, really love the book too, and that's the biggest reward we could get. So,
and let's be honest, when we talk about small, we're not talking about their height. You know, it's not as though they're sort of sad pandas. You know, they can be all sizes. We're talking about numbers for the whole thing. It's love letters to fans and so on. In the studio, I suppose we've probably got a kind of good breakdown because Gabriella Peralta, our girl from Gibraltar, never heard of Fringe, have you?
No.
What treats you have to look in forward to when you actually...
We'll have to remedy that.
Exactly.
Yes.
And soon-to-be English graduate Holly Parker Fringe?
No, I watched Once Upon a Time, which is on here.
Steady. You know, Once Upon a Time, that will come up in a matter of moments. Don't worry about that. Yeah, and a whole heap of other goodies from there. Rachel, keen fan of Fringe, obviously.
I love Fringe.
So describe what magical things you're discovering there. I mean, they've got all sorts of goodies in there.
Yes, I'm just looking at your book, and it's brilliant. I love the way it's laid out. It looks like Fringe. Like, it's really good. I might have to buy this.
Oh, I hope so. That's nice. We love to hear that. That's good. Yeah, we wanted it to come up like a big scrapbook of everything that he collected in the 5 years of the show. So it's interactive, you know, and it's not just a book where you just kind of flip through and read, but there's always something to discover on the page.
Yeah, it's brilliant. The layout, it's so, like... visually, it looks brilliant, and it looks like what Fringe would look like as a book, which is what it is, but yeah, it's brilliant.
And
thank you.
Curiously, the perfect way to really follow the article the Ark Before Noah and Irving Winkel, because obviously that could in many ways be a fringe case, couldn't it, Rachel?
You know, it
that
could
whole
be.
Cuneiform,
yeah.
The battle there, the exorcism of the demons, and so on and so forth. A little treat to look forward to when you listen on the podcast. Clearly, where we that sort of will go up for you, Tara. But excitement continues, you know, unabated with the whole system. And Holly, you mentioned this little number. Yes, the scarily spooky but somehow wonderful sort of next stage for some of the developers of Lost when they decided to say, well, look, the island's been sorted out. What can we do now? We can go to Storybrook. And lo and behold, Tara's done another text on that as well. Yay!
We worked out a big project last year that kind of were two commemorative kind of fan magazines that then morphed into kind of a companion guide, and that was a lot of fun to work on.
And when you're actually doing that, because I do sense in all your work, Tara, there's a labour of love that comes across there, which is very positive, because sometimes you find that when people do guides, etc., they can kind of be a little bit cynical, a little bit sceptical, and so on, and they can say, oh, this didn't work, and so on. You can kind of deconstruct to the extent that you forget the reasons you fell in love with the programme in the first place. Does it kind of reinforce your appreciation of the series, or do you, when you finished a book on, say, Once Upon a Time or Fringe, say, right, that's it, I cannot watch it again for another few years, I've had enough?
No, the books, you know, obviously publishing is a very interesting thing, and a lot of people do run out to buy anything about their favorite show, but then it's, you know, people moving to their tablets and such, so it's actually less opportunities to do these kinds of projects, and so I'm a huge passionate fan of when I do them, to try to make them as special as possible for the fans that are going to go out and buy them, and I love the medium of television and film, and when I get to work on a project like this, I try to put myself in the mindset of a fan, thinking, well, if I'm going to bother buying and putting some money into doing the picking this up, what would I want? And so it's a huge part of when I'm putting it together with a publisher or an editor. Or a partner like Paul Terry, that we really try to put ourselves in a place of making it really something that's worth having.
I have to ask, though, you once upon a time, even trying to tell friends or people that you're just talking to...
Sure, should we test that now? Gabriella, have you ever heard of Once Upon a Time, the series?
I feel like I've seen an episode. Oh. Is it about characters that come, like, are in a random town,
yeah,
and then time stops, and then they
in
come
fairy
back,
tales,
and then fairy tales, and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw an episode.
It's really good, really, really good.
My sister
good.
Loved
really
it.
Worth
My sister absolutely loved it.
There have been 44, and they're now into the third season. So
oh, God.
An
yeah,
episode.
Way behind.
Yes.
And concentrate on it, because there's so much that goes on. But basically, because there's so much that goes on, and it's really difficult to try and explain, how did you try and put that, or how did you manage to put that all together in a book, coherently?
That one was, I was more of a contributor on that, so I had an editor that kind of guided and assigned several of us to write certain sections of it. So I did several interviews, and then I helped them with the season guide. So a lot of it was going back, watching episodes, you know, breaking apart the most important things, because you're 100% right. Watching that show, you need a flow chart. It's like, okay, where are they now? And they're in the Storybrook, and now they're not. Now they're in the fairy tale land. So you have to really chart out a lot of where the characters are in the past, where they are in the present, and so, but I'm kind of used to that. Most of the, obviously, most of the stuff I write about is complicated, so I kind of have this very methodical process of when I start a project, kind of getting things really organized, thinking about compartmentalizing things, and then that kind of helps me work through an order and a logic to how I write.
It's like a masterclass in actually doing a series guide for the general public as well as the fan aficionado. We would be most remiss if we didn't actually mention this, of course. Yes, the big question is, what's happening to Chloe O'Brien? Now she's working for a WikiLeaks-style free information movement, a fact signalled by her Stieg Larsson makeover. All tattoos, eyeliner and emo scrappy haircut, according to Gerard Gilbert, writing about 24 Live Another Day. Have you caught it as yet? Is it one of those things which you think, no, I've already done my series guides to 24, I can't take many more Jack Bauer excitements?
No, I was so excited to know it was coming back. You know, it was, it definitely needed, you know, to kind of rest. I think, you know, Jack was tired. He'd had a very few rough years
He'd had 7 days, hadn't he? Let's face it. You know.
I know. It was pretty brutal. He'd lost about everybody he had to lose, and you know, was a man on his own when he walked away at the end of the last season. So I thought it was great that they brought it back. Everybody had a chance to kind of breathe and refresh creatively, and it is very funny to see, you know, kind of the Elizabeth Sanders version of Chloe with like you said, the goth makeup. But it's really nice to have the show.
And back, I suppose technically we say 24 live another day. Should it be 24 live another half day? Because it's only 12. It's only 12 hours. Is that because he's in London? Does he sort of think he can do twice as much in half the time? I don't know.
I think so. Well, isn't it the time zone? You guys have us by 5 hours. So, yeah, he's much more efficient in your time zone.
Exactly. Very much post 9/11, a bit like Battlestar Galactica, of course. It is one of those areas that we come through. Are we entering another era of sci-fi, do you think? Obviously, we've had Alias, we've had 24, and so Fringe, arguably, has got elements which kind of cross a spy with drama, with the X-Files and so on. Or is it just a case of the fashion going around, and it's only going to be a matter of time before we actually go back to the joys of Irwin Allen approaches and Land of the Giants? Maybe not.
No, people like to see things blowing up and beating people up. So I think 24 was just that there's this huge bout of kind of nostalgia and bringing back properties that, you know, people really, really loved. And 24 was such a tremendous international hit. I think it coming back, if it wasn't going to be in a movie, which they took a really long time to try to figure out if they could just do it in a movie and then
very long movie
was the best place. Yeah, but they I think you know, it was that in its own little bubble. It was them just trying to find the best medium for it and also the best ideas. They were a little worn out after the long run that they originally had. So, but I think I think that there's always a space for those kinds of, like you said, the action sci-fi. And I think the trending for this year with the new pilots that are going to be coming out soon is not pushing that much towards it. So I think, you know, when you get these kind of event ones that come back, they still make a lot of noise when they hit, which is nice. So we'll see. I mean, if, you know, Jack and Chloe do well with this adventure, we could see the back 12, you know, another 12 hours. Maybe next year.
Who knows? Yeah, no, what wonderful excitement awaits from that particular perspective. Moving on, of course, we need to sort of mention the fact that the genre continues to roll out. Gabriella, any questions or thoughts that you'd like to put to Tara Bennett, our official East Coast correspondent extraordinaire? Now, of course, that other East Coast correspondents have moved to the West Coast. It's very confusing.
So are you working on any new books? I think I saw you're working on Rio.
Well, yeah, I just had The Art of Rio, which is an art book on the both of the animated films from Blue Sky Studios. So that just came out, and I'm actually been working on two books at the same time for the last 2 months. And so one has been announced, which is, it's called Showrunners, and it's a book about the people that make television. And it's a documentary that's actually coming out this year from some lovely Irish filmmakers, Death Doyle, and they went and talked to everybody that makes shows, from J.J. Abrams to Joss Whedon to the guys that made Fringe, and asked them what it's like to make TV in today's world of many, many channels and lots of different, options for people to watch. And I've taken a lot of what they couldn't put inside of the documentary into the book. So it's a really comprehensive conversation with a lot of really, really talented people about the art of television and how business and creativity have to kind of work in tandem to make it happen.
And of course, there was a time when showrunners, which would be referred to as producers, but now it becomes the norm, really. It's you know, you're a showrunner. Does that mean I have to jog? No, you're just actually producing the whole show. But then I'm a producer. Very confusing. One of our ace directors, Ilana Rain, whose birthday is today. Happy birthday, Ilana. Has just
Happy
reminded
birthday.
Us. Yes, she's over on the West Coast, so 10:30 a.m. PST, 6:30 GMT TV. Ilana will be joining us. And she actually said, as it's her birthday, she's taking the liberty. Now, this, Tara, is from the lady who actually directed the movie We Are All Cylons, and indeed the fabulous short Ellipse. She's now decided, and this is one could be the focus of your next book, the third book, actually. Ilana's taking the liberty of posting a video online that is unrivaled in its capacity to transmit the joyful essence of the bikini roller disco craze.
Sounds great.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
What other show takes you from The Ark Before Noah through 24, Fringe? How's it going, Rachel? Do we need to send out for medical help? Are you okay?
It's a brilliant book. I really like it.
We're not going to get away from Fringe. It will continue to sort of echo. And I didn't even do an Australian accent for Walter Bishop. No, I didn't. Actually, he didn't do an Australian accent himself, really. So we'll look at that. We should actually get some Fringe characters on the show, actually. We'll work on that. Yes, but the bikini roller disco craze. And in case of the video, she's even put a YouTube link on it. That's amazing. Yeah, it's phenomenal.
I have to see that. You've given me my afternoon's entertainment. Thank you very much. I had no idea what I was going to do. Now I do.
Well, we were going to play you England's entry into the Eurovision Song Contest, but I think we'll hold back on that a little while longer. She's the front line. Tallulah Rendell from the Banshee of the Moon will be up very shortly. Fionn Hill is joining us, and Fionn is currently cycling from Miami all the way up to Vancouver. So that's Florida.
That's a long way.
It is. Last week she was in Kentucky. So, you know, just into Illinois. So we'll find out where Fionn Hill is kind of coming out in the near future. But what are the last two questions we need to put to Tara Bennett now? Rachel.
We would like to ask you, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Absolutely. I have, like I said, you've entertained me. I know what I'm going to do this afternoon, and I can't get any better than that. Thank you.
Yes. Excellent. And can we look forward to talking to you again sometime soon?
Oh, I hope so. Yes, please. I'd love to come back.
A round of applause for Tara Bennett, please. Yay! Actually, Holly, just to ask you, no relation to the crime writer?
Linda Bennett.
Are you any relation to Linda Bennett, Tara?
No, but, you know, maybe we can lie and say we are.
No, the Midweek Drive always maintains its honesty and integrity, you know, much like Walternut.
As it should. Come along if you feel like a room without a roof. Come along if you feel like happiness is the truth.
So, a Midweek Drive on Siren 107.3 FM. I did say never ever start a sentence with so. It's just so last year. That's Tallulah Rendell and Trouble. We're watching, at least the team are watching, the Ilana Rain posted bikini roller disco. It's a thought, but not as wonderful a thought as Tallulah Rendell being back on the show. How are you, Tal?
Very well, how are you?
Yeah, very good indeed. The guys were very impressed with the line, monumental apologies for missing the gig a couple of weeks ago. But it was all down to Led Zeppelin, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's forgivable.
Yeah.
Hopefully we kept you entertained with the voicemail messages.
That was so bad. I'm so sorry. But if it does make you feel any better, I was sitting in a studio with these tape decks, the old original tape, going round listening to Led Zeppelin 2 and 3. It's a pretty amazing experience.
Exactly. And we can understand that. We can understand the sort of the tension and the scenario of that. It all works well. Do you know, we're only about 3 weeks away from when the official world premiere in the wonderful Rebecca Hossack's gallery, The Banshee and the Moon, actually launches, and I should hopefully be there on the Thursday evening, all being well.
So
great excitement on that sort of basis. We've been running through a number of tracks because we didn't quite receive anything today. It's all right. We're going to have a little selection. We've got Gabriella Peralta, our girl from Gibraltar.
Hey.
Take hi. Don't be sad, Panda.
I'm a happy Tal.
Have you ever heard the phrase sad panda, happy panda?
It's happy poppy, though.
Happy.
Sad panda, happy poppy, awkward, like turtle, awkward giraffe.
Is this something that's
awkward whale?
Is this a Gibraltarian sort of affectation you've brought to the
show? It's the University of Lincoln, me and my friend adaptation.
I think we're showing our age.
Rachel,
we just fell down with the kids.
Clearly, no. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I might be Dr. Doolittle. Any sort of, have you come across these phrases?
Yeah, we were just talking about them. There are a few, but we were saying that my sister had a few when I went home, and she thought I was weird for not knowing what they were.
Holly, is this something that happens in York as well?
Awkward turtle has been around quite a while.
Awkward turtle.
But
what awkward? I mean,
well,
why?
If you put one hand on top of the other, right? If you put with your palms down,
I hope you're doing this,
Tara,
whilst you've got the telephone.
With your palms
in hand.
Down, right? Put one hand over the other with your fingers interspersed.
Interlaced.
Interlaced. That is a better word, right? And then bend your fingers so you're Yeah, knuckles
like
are down.
Like you're praying.
And then, yeah, and then rotate your thumbs so it looks like a turtle.
Like fins swimming.
Oh.
You go to university to discover.
We study a lot, as you can tell.
Yeah. Did you not do this at the University of Manchester when you're doing your English degree? Honestly, tell. Yes,
I feel like I missed out. Well,
clearly, you didn't get into enough awkward situations.
Yeah. I think I'm making up for it now, though.
If nothing else, at least we've got the title of the fourth album, Happy Panda, Sad Panda. It's genius.
Oh, awkward situations.
Awkward situations. It's fantastic. Although you're absolutely right, Tal, to say that Trouble is one of my favourites of your sort of early work and material, it was actually Holly who made that suggestion when we ran past a number of lines from there. So another classic. So, Gabriella, would you like to sort of select a Tallulah Randall number from this? And then we can talk with Tal about what it, I mean, we'll run the part. Older Than the Hills, Back to You, Nothing Is Over, Run, Let the River Run, Shine On, Pieces, Eyes.
Shine On.
Shine On.
Yeah.
So shine on for that. A bit like lights in the galaxy in every sense of the word. Okay, if you stay with us, Tal, Shine On is with us now on Sire 107.3 FM.
Great.
Let go.